My name is Sam Edwards, and today is December 1st, 2016, and I'm here with Frank. Actually, Frank, I don't even know how to pronounce your last name.
Cabell.
Yes. I think Paul has actually correct me in a different pronunciation. I've been confused since. Anyhow, I'm here with Frank Cabell, and today we're talking about employee ownership, the culture of it, structure, and the history of a company he used to work with. And helped found Chroma Technology. Frank, would you like to go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I've always had a scientific background to some degree. I was a lab technician in many fields in my early days. I got a job at Omega Optical in doing thin film coding. In around 1979, and Omega Optical was a very unconventional high tech company. It was a sole proprietorship run by a hippie boss of sorts, and he believed in empowering his workers in every way possible. We used our initiative. We were able to innovate and be inventive. We would tackle every kind of job. We would tear the machines apart and work on them and figure out how they were how to put them back together again. We were very much self-managing. I met my wife to be at Omega Optical in 79, and she, although she'd had no experience of optical coding, ended up managing the production group there for a while. Everything was left up to the employees, and they felt very empowered. It turned out in the long run that was a carefully crafted illusion, because Bob Johnson, the owner, had very firm ideas about how far our involvement would take us. I mean, it would get us bonuses perhaps and do a lot of the legwork that he didn't want to do. But when all said and done, he kept tight control over the company. I left after about 4 years and started a stained glass business for a while, and then decided to go back and carry on at Omega Optical. So I worked there with a hiatus from 1979 until 1991. Just around 1991, some of my associates at Omega Optical decided they'd had enough of putting out as though there was worker participation and not getting anything back other than an autocratic response from the boss. So for various reasons, one person quit, another person was fired, some of us decided we'd had enough. A group of us got together and decided to start our own company, which we did in 91. There were seven of us to begin with, which soon was reduced to six, and my role was primarily in the beginning to be the person that designed and built the first little production shop that we put together equipment, and that's how it all began.
So when certain members, when certain founders of Chroma had left Omega, at the time you were not working with Omega.
Right. I knew that this was going to happen soon, so I handed in my resignation to Omega and spent a brief period doing odd jobs until such time as Chroma became fully established. But I was right in there pretty much the day that the doors opened and we had to start building walls and hauling in machinery. So yeah, I was there from the get go.
Were you part of some of the, you know, telegraphing conversations with Paul Millman and a few of the other founders before that all kind of came to fruition?
Yes, we would meet. I can't even remember now. I think I might still have been working at Omega when we would gather informally in bars and various apartments to talk about what if. what if we started a company? How would we do it? I had no real axe to grind one way or the other in terms of its company structure, but Paul was very adamant that any venture should be fully employee owned, and there would be no one boss of any description, benevolent or autocratic. So I went along with that. Sounded like a good idea. Dick Stewart and Paul Millman were the two that were most concerned with the structure of the company, its governance. Jay and Vim and myself and Rusty were much more concerned with the technical aspects of the company, how we would simply get the equipment and make it work for us. And Wendy was the sort of greased all the wheels. She was purchaser and accountant to begin with, and Paul Minder, and sort of held it all together in a very with common sense, and because the original concept was equal ownership, we all pretty much drifted into our own fields of strength and just took it from there. We didn't know what each other were doing to a lot of the time, but we assumed that everybody was doing the right thing. Vim was off writing software in one room. Rusty was off building electronics in another. I was constructing workbenches and ventilation hoods and plumbing and pumps and equipment. We all went our own separate ways, and Paul was probably the most frustrated. I mean, he was getting orders in, but he was not a very practical person. He was waiting for the rest of us to actually get something online. And I think it took us about 6 months before we made 6 to 8 months before we made our first product.
So up until now in my interviews, I have not heard that Dick Stewart was also one of the champions for employee ownership. For the most part, I've heard that it was, you know, essentially Rusty wanting some unbeknownst people who wanted some part of an equity stake in owning the company, contrasted with Paul, who wanted to be fully employee owned.
Yes, and I think Paul and Dick were the most adamant that they didn't want any outside investment. All the investment came from ourselves and from family members, so that we could retain full control. But I think it was mostly, well, and in fact, I don't. It was Dick's in-laws, his father-in-law and mother-in-law, who together provided the most significant portion of the startup capital. Did you know that?
Maybe not that explicitly. I know today when I was talking with Paul, he said that for the most part, maybe it was Dick, the loans that I guess the original founders and yourself had taken out were probably paid back in full by like 97, 98. I mean, I know that much,
yeah,
but not quite.
It may even have been earlier than that. But I think the entire startup capital for the company was, I think, about 250,000, maybe. And of that, something like 100,000 came from Dick's wife's parents, and Paul actually put up the lion's a much more significant portion of the starting capital than anybody else, I think. He had done well in other ventures years before and had a certain amount of money invested in the stock market, and he basically liquidated all that in order to. There was a time when we ran out of money and we still weren't ready to go into production, so Paul resignedly offered up the rest of his life savings. And I remember him saying, this had better work, I'm going to be broke. Well, we were all taking a risk, but Paul took a pretty big risk with his personal finances, but people basically they did what they could. I didn't have much capital at all. In fact Paul went around lending everybody money so that they could put in money of their own, and then we paid it back to, and then paid it back to Paul. But in the end, it all worked out, and all of the investors were paid back in full with at a high return, I think something like 12% by within 7 or 8 years. So it worked well.
So what was the, you know, after you got into production, what were the first couple of years producing like for the company and for you and the other founders?
It was a very enjoyable time. There were a small number of us. We were able to keep abreast of things. We slowly added more people. We unconsciously kept up the decision-making process that we'd started with. We were just a bunch of friends that trusted each other, and we would make sort of decisions on the fly, as it were. There'd be a crisis of some kind, we'd solve the problems that arose in a very informal way. We never really felt that there was much need for structure.
Yeah, I mean,
and I think most of us, as maybe many entrepreneurs do, don't like structure. They don't like governance. That's why they strike out on their own. And we'd come from a place, a workplace that didn't have much structure at all. So not having structure was seemed the reasonable thing to do. Many years before, I had lived on a hippie commune for a while, and our watchword there, I forget who coined it, was systemless accomplishment. In other words, if you wanted to get something done and you had agreement that it was a good thing to do, you got it done without too much system. But of course, as Chroma grew and expanded at a lightning pace, there had to be a system, and it would be unfair otherwise to bring people in off the street and expect them to know intuitively how a bunch of people that have known each other for a long time work together. You can't really just expect people to fall into that understanding. So there has to be structure. But what kind of structure that should be is always open to debate. By the time I retired, I don't think that structure had come to fruition.
It's still in a changing and continuing process. So I guess on the note of the friendship you and the other founders had, how long had you all known each other? Because I know a few of you had worked at Omega for quite a long time before you came to starting Chroma.
Yes, I had known Dick Stewart prior to Omega. He was a neighbor up the road from where I lived on a hippie commune. So I first knew Dick Stewart back in the mid-70s. I didn't know Paul when I joined Omega Optical, I was one of 12 people. So it was a very small company when I started working there, and after me came Dick Stewart, Jay Reichman, Wim Auer, Wendy Cross, Paul Millman. I probably had worked at Omega longer than any of them.
I think Paul might have been the last one being hired in like 88, 89.
Yes, that's right, he didn't get on with Bob Johnson at all, and didn't last long. He was out. He liked to pick fights, but on the other hand, he was a brilliant salesman. So Bob Johnson tolerated him for his ability.
And for only so long, though.
Yes.
I mean,
So and he did get fired in the end. Whereas Jay, you know, Jay had come straight out of college, young, starry-eyed. Scientist, and I think after a few years, he saw the shortcomings of the amateur, sometimes amateurish way that Omega Optical was run, and he took a sabbatical or he quit. I can't remember which, but he didn't intend to go back to Omega. He'd had enough of that. He might have gone. Joined a high-tech company in Boston or something like that.
Yeah, I'm looking to interview him next week, but from what I've heard, he was doing some very high-intensity research, possibly in the Hubble Space Telescope. So when he had come back from that, he was very exhausted and had actually taken the sabbatical, but yes. also then ended in quitting and coming yes. to yes. starting
he was, Hubble. Yeah, he was, I don't know, I think he was the project leader for the Hubble Space Telescope. I mean, different coding companies got different parts of the Hubble Space Telescope project, and I think Omega Optical, I think they made filters for what they call the wide field planetary camera, I think it was. I remember making some of those codings myself, but I think Jay was in charge of the project, which meant working very closely with NASA people who were very picky about quality control and so on. So yeah, that probably burned him out to some extent, because it's not an easy thing to do when you're working in a company, you know, in a Brattleboro that doesn't even have a clean room. It was quite primitive. Omega started in the basement of a Unitarian church, and then moved and then expanded to another building, which was the old newspaper printing building. So it was pretty dirty and funky.
Was the church operating at the time you were producing in its basement?
No. The church had become defunct a few years earlier. Well, the Unitarian community had built a new building in West Brattleboro called the West Village Meeting House. So there was an empty stone church, which I guess Bob Johnson bought, because prior to that he'd been making optical codings in his shed at the back of his house.
That just sounds very sketchy to me, but I also don't understand the time or, you know, I guess the industry.
Yeah, well, Bob Johnson had learnt his craft in Boston at various coding places. I forget which, Ed Barr, I think it was. And then he decided to go into business for himself, hired about three people, friends mostly, and started his first coding company in with about three machines, as I say, in a shed or a barn on his own property in West Brattleboro. So by the time I joined the company in the basement of the church, it was about three times the size it was when Bob first started it. And it seemed, I mean, it was funky, but it seemed okay to us. I mean, I'd never had any experience of an optical coding company before, though I should have realized that most of them are a lot cleaner than any stone church could be.
So I think, because if Paul got hired in the late 80s, was it about like 8 to 10 years that you were working with Omega before Paul got hired, correct?
Yes. Yes. I started in 79, quit in about 83, and then rejoined again in about 85. And then I think Paul was hired about, 86, 87? Would that make sense? Maybe 88? He was there about 3 years before.
Yeah. So I think 88 is probably a little bit closer.
Yes.
And from what I understand, he was able to help through his sales. I talked to him about that today, where he didn't have any experience selling optical filters.
Right, not at all.
And it took him about 6 months to get to the point where he thought he was proficient in it. And then over those 3 years, I think the sales of the company went from about 300,000 to about 1 million. Hmm.
And there was a simple reason for that, really. Bob Johnson was a hermit. He was always uncomfortable in the wider world of scientists, technology. He just liked to stay in the basement and invent things. But he didn't know how to sell. And he never really went to any of the trade shows and the conventions and whatever. Whereas Paul is an entirely opposite person. He's outgoing, gregarious. He loves to schmooze, and he he has a he has a background that fit in perfectly well with a lot of loud, fast talking academics in the various sciences. He just got on with people. He learned their names. He showed an interest in what they were doing, whether it was National Institute of Health or you name it, whatever you know, this astronomy community. I mean, he cottoned on, and he particularly got excited about fluorescence microscopy and all the new avenues that optical coatings were leading into. So he was a natural as a salesman, and that's what it took. It took being enthusiastic and going out and meeting people and being on the road, which he still does to this day. Bob Johnson didn't understand that or didn't want to do it. Maybe he understood it, but he was reluctant to do it. So it's no wonder that Paul was the first really successful salesperson.
So then moving into the 90s with the development of Chroma, how integral was Paul's ability to sell the filters to the growth, you know, the lightning fast growth that you said that Chroma had?
Oh, it was entirely his ability to sell and interest customers in Chroma's products, coupled with Vim's ability to write software that for the first time enabled our machinery to be automated, meaning that we could produce way more with fewer people, and more timely. So, Paul would say everyone's as important as everybody else, which is true to some extent. But it was Paul's ability to network he was accused of stealing customer files and addresses and telephone numbers from Omega, which was all nonsense. The fact is, Paul had made personal friends with many of the people that turned out to be our best customers. He knew them. He knew their families. He would stay with them after trade shows. So he just had that. He had that networking ability and that base of friends and associates all across the country and around the world. So him being able to sell whatever we came up with and it invented, and Vim being able to, and Jay being able to come up with new designs and faster ways of making that product, it just worked for us. The time was right. Now everybody has automated evaporators, but we thought we were the only people, and we probably were back then. And in fact, some expert witness at the trial on behalf of Bob Johnson claimed that we couldn't have done what we did. I mean, he said, oh, I forget what company he worked for, a company on Route 128, said, oh, we tried to come up with ways of automating this machinery, but you can't do it. It takes the human touch. Well, that was not true. We had done it, and we did it within a year or more of starting out, thanks to Vim's genius. Paul's personality and Bim's genius are probably what were the two most. And Jay's scientific mind are probably the three things that contributed to Chroma's success.
So, in thinking about their skills and the ability to kind of, you know, work competitively with other companies, how do you think their skills helped Chroma kind of compete at the high end filters and work with, you know, very high-level scientists and other companies producing very, you know, advanced technology?
Well, again, it was the software that Vim wrote that was the key to it all. I don't want to go into too much technical detail, but in order to make an optical coating, you have to carefully monitor the deposition of a number of very precise microscopic layers. And prior to the invention, if you like, of high-end or high-end optical coatings. Maybe an optical coating had 20 or 30 layers, and that wasn't beyond the reach of a person, a careful person, to do manually, just like, you know, knitting a few lines of line, just like knitting without dropping a stitch, or weaving a carpet without making a mistake. If you concentrated, you could get so far, but the demands, as the uses for, especially in biology, as the uses for optical coatings became more sophisticated, and the demand was there for optical coatings with way more layers, in order to outperform or to adequately perform, it's almost impossible for a human to make those coatings without making mistakes, and if you make mistakes, it doesn't work right, the product. So, but when you have a computer making those coatings, it can just go on and on, making, putting down precise layers one after the other, and that was it. It was Vim writing the software that enabled us to make the kind of filters with more accuracy than anybody else had done up to that point. This is how I understand it. Other competitors might claim that they could also do that, but we were able to make highly sophisticated coatings with the aid of computer software that nobody else could do. And we could also design them. Vim didn't only just make write software to control the machinery. He wrote software to design coatings, very very user friendly thin film design programs, program. So that when I first started out, you came up with a crude design from a chart. And you tried it, and if it didn't work, you tinkered with the design and tried it again. And you never really knew if it didn't work because you'd made errors, or if it didn't work because it was the wrong design. Vim wrote a thin film design program that meant you could sit there for an hour and rattle off thousands of iterations of designs till you came up with the right one. And then you knew how it was meant to look, and then you would get a computer, the automated machine to make it, and it was magic. It pushed in the 10 years from 79 when I started. It was all unbelievably crude, but by 91, when Vim had come on board and written his software, it was as different as, oh, I don't know, drilling holes in people's heads to let the evil spirits out, or performing sophisticated brain surgery. It was a quantum leap. It was a quantum leap, and that's why we were so successful with just a handful of people. I'm still amazed at what we were able to do, because I'd been in there from the earliest stages with the most primitive equipment, and it was all hit and miss and trial and error. And Vim brought it to an exact science. And then Paul could say, we make the best, most accurate coatings. You'll want to try ours. And people did. And
they kept coming back.
They kept coming back, yeah.
All right, so yeah. What year, you know, to move forward a little bit away from, I guess, the technicalities of Vim's work,
yeah.
What year was it that you, I guess, left Chroma?
Left Chroma?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'll backtrack a little bit, but I want to get that date so we can kind of...
When did I leave Chroma? Let's see. Maybe 10 years ago?
So about 2005, 2006?
Yes, maybe a little earlier than that. I think I was 59, and I'm now 60. 69. Yeah, so about 10 years ago. Yes. Yeah.
So coming out of the, you know, the...
And why did I leave? Because I felt that I was no longer contributing in a meaningful way.
Was it because of the size of the company and how it was growing?
Yes, it was the size of the company. There was no room for I mean, in the early days, for example, the first five evaporators, vacuum systems, we basically built them ourselves. But we would buy used equipment and completely refurbish it. Get some help from one of our. We did have one investor, I've just remembered, other than people's family, and that was Vim's friend David Bradford, who owned a precision machine shop in Brattleboro and was a good friend of Vim's. And he not only invested some money, but he made the high-tech interiors of our vacuum chambers, which Vim and Jay and others had designed. I've lost my train of thought now. But in the very early days, we put together the stuff ourselves. We made machines. By the time I left, we were buying machines that cost $1 million a piece from a company in Canada, such as the one that Nick Day worked for. Everything had shifted to a much more professional level, if you like, and there wasn't really much room for somebody like me that liked to invent bits and pieces and put stuff together. All of the things we did in the early days, or I did that worked well, now looked old fashioned. And I was no longer a plant manager. We had a professional plant manager that took care of things and would in the early days, if something broke, we'd fix it ourselves. We'd get the pigeons out of the air cleaning ducts and sort of, you know, put a new piece of screen over it. By the time I left, Cromer was big enough that one simply hired air conditioning experts and all the rest of it to fix things. So I was no longer Mr. Fix-It. I was just somebody doing the same mundane job every day. And I was also a little... I was still stuck to old ways, so I didn't really fit in with the new computerized structure and... The processing, the way that the work flowed. Shortly before I left, I did something. I was able to do something the old way, but Dick wasn't very pleased. He said, in fact, he said I had made some filters for a customer. For a sample set of filters without any paperwork at all, without going through all of the initiating the work orders and the invoices and all of that stuff. I just simply made these things and gave them to the sales guy to show his customer, and Dick was outraged. You can't do things like that anymore. And he wrote an email to the company saying I'd gone completely outside of the system, which I had, and I was kind of amused by that. But there was no room for that sort of renegade entrepreneurial spirit in the new structured Cromer. So I just felt I'd had enough. I was getting old. I didn't want to be there until my 70s, until I was 70. So I'd had a good run. I was older than most, apart from Paul and Wendy, I think. Well, Vim is younger than me, and Jay is considerably younger, and Dick is younger. So I was one of the older people, and I decided it was time to bow out.
So we've talked a lot about the beginning of Cromer, and we've kind of jumped to the end of your tenure there. So, mm-hmm. What was the end of the 90s like for the company? And going up to 2003 when the company left the cotton mill and came up to Bell's Falls?
Well, of course, the trial, the lawsuit interposed right in the middle of that period. And
do you want to describe the lawsuit briefly?
Well, I'm sure it's been described plenty of times.
I actually don't think I've had any of the other founders or employee owners describe it for the project, but for the sake of it being part of this conversation, just very briefly.
Well, it was a very worrying time, I think, for some of us. Probably because... originally, Cromer had been sued by Omega Optical, and then a week or so later, Bob Johnson decided to up the ante, and sue us as individuals. So it wasn't just the company that was being sued; but the defendants were named individuals. So we stood, presumably, if we had lost. I mean, if Cromer had lost as a corporation, it would have had to have. Done something, paid fines or paid back what Bob Johnson's lawyer was calling unlawful enrichment. But the fact that we were sued as individuals, I don't know what that meant. We might have been. I mean, if we'd been fined. What's the word called it was a civil suit, so you would have to pay damages, I guess, is the word, costs. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I could have lost the house, I suppose, or any livelihood, life savings, whatever. So it was an anxious time for a while. But I can't really say too much about the middle years. I mean, Cromer grew steadily. We probably hired on 3 or 4 people a year, 5 people a year. Not everybody got it. There were people that had come from... I mean, we were looking... The early company culture was we'll find local people and train them to do the work. But then after a while, it became clear that, you know, Vim, in particular, espoused hiring people with experience. If we could find somebody that worked at a coding company on Route 128 or whatever, that would be a good person. So we send out. We looked further afield for people with the right technical qualifications. So we would get people who had those qualifications, but at the same time had such a were so locked into a conventional corporate mode of work that they didn't get it. They didn't realize often that you work the extra hour and put out the extra little bit of effort because this was your company. You get people that tried to goof off whenever they could because that's what you did in corporate America. You did your job, but if no one was looking, you went and had a smoke outside or something like that. I would, if you could look at a graph of our hiring and firing or hiring and letting go, there would be upward peaks, but there would be dips. I mean, we thought to begin with that this was such an amazing place that we'd started, where you had all these benefits and ownership and shares and whatever. Nobody would ever want to leave, but you got people that didn't get it and they didn't last long. So the middle years were there were growing pains. A lot of people that didn't quite fit in and had to be let go, and it was an expensive proposition. Even if people had only been there a year or so, they would have gotten shares and so on. But it just very slowly and inexorably became more and more like a factory, and less like a bunch of people putting together, Microsoft in their backyard. I mean, that's typical of it. Any company. I think the real problem is that if there is a problem, the problem probably was that some people, perhaps Paul, for example, were more wedded to having complete control or a lot of control, and didn't really trust people to come in and do that. So we've never really come up with anything that's a model for the future, I don't think. But it never bothered me. I just did my thing and assumed that everybody else was doing their thing too, and nobody was really worried about that kind of stuff. I mean, we were successful. We got paid. We expanded and we grew. It seemed to me self-evident how you should manage yourself. I was never too concerned. I've always been a person that's worked for small companies and managed myself, and never really had any experience of an IBM or whatever. Even when I was a lab technician, I basically, they told you what you had to do, and you got on and did it, and didn't worry about the governance from above.
So when Cromer was expanding through the late 90s and the early 2000s, when you guys were looking at new employees or how people fit the culture, what were you looking for? I understand that the founders, for the most part, because you guys were such a tight-knit group, you already had an idea of who you were and what you were doing and why. Yeah. But when finding new people to put into that team, what were you looking for?
I would just say to people, you've got to be resourceful. You've got to solve your own problems. you're not going to get too much help. You'll get all the technical help you want, but if you're trying to figure out what you're supposed to be doing when or who you're accountable to, good luck, and don't worry if somebody shouts at you. Paul shouts at everybody. But you're on your own, basically. Treat it as you would your own company. That's what I told people. I said, you know, I'm not that. There's no managers. I mean, I can give you I can give you hints about how to do your job better, but I can't tell you what to do. I'm not over you. There is no hierarchy like that. And it's a good place to work, so it's in your own interest to make a success of it.
So, I mean, in the other interviews I've been doing on the, for Chroma, and as you've kind of indicated too, you know, there is this sense of what it means to be an employee owner, and this might be kind of it's hard to kind of nail down what it means, but if you could briefly try to tell me what it means to be an employee owner, you can go for it. I'm just curious because right. Yeah.
Well, I suppose it means that it on some level it means you have the autonomy that you would if you were working for yourself. Mm. If you'd opened for a number of years I had a stained glass studio and I worked for myself, and I always treated Chroma as though that's what it should be like. You make your own decisions and you cross check with other people, but basically it should make you feel like you're working for yourself.
And I think Paul has indicated not only in a company meeting yesterday, but also in the interview with him that I had with him, there's a relationship between individual interest and collective interest. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that relationship and being an employee owner.
I just assumed that it should be obvious to everybody that it should feel like you're working for yourself, but at the same time, you should be aware that everybody is dependent on everybody else for the success of the venture. I don't know. I never gave it too much thought, but then I've never been somebody that liked even being on the board. I didn't like telling people what to do or making those big decisions because. That's just not my style. I'm not a. But then I don't think any of us were. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the typical number of entrepreneurs to start a company is. Maybe it's just one, or maybe it's just two. Here, you had seven people all dovetailing dovetailing in with each other, forming a sort of collective. Startup person, but if you separate them all, they're all incapable of doing most of the things. You know, I mean, Vim is hopeless at telling people what to do. Paul just shouts at people to tell them what to do. Dick sort of tells people what to do, but in a mild and friendly enough way that half the time they don't do it. Jay's got his head in the clouds. I mean, none of us were really. If there was anything missing. In the mix, it was management skills. None of us had or really wanted to have management skills. And so we didn't. We had technical skills. We had technical skills and creative skills, but not really strong on the management, which is probably why to this day it's the weak area. If it is a weak area, I don't know.
I think to say that it might be weak is... I think...
Not weak, then.
Fairly reductionist, because it's not... There is management, but there isn't. They're forming the structure, but, you know, it's still not clear. But that's not to say that it isn't there and that things aren't getting right. done. It's just the company, and as I guess you've experienced through your tenure there, trying to figure out how to be more... I guess part of the reasons it contributed to you leaving, how to figure out how to make things more consistent... record it, track it, and make sure that, you know, it's doing what the system should be.
Yeah.
And I think, from my observations in Chroma, that's really what they're trying to do and have been trying to do for a long time. But it's interesting, not only with Chroma having this third way form, but apart from cooperatives and ESOPs, that management, Now, management and like how it's owned were sometimes a lack for one thing or other, but also a want for something that those models didn't offer.
Mm. Yeah, it's hard for me to really see that part of it clearly. I mean, it could be that the closest model to Chroma is something like, you know, when people talk about evolution, for example, there are all these different forces at play. I mean, there's natural selection, but there's also environmental pressure, and then there's also luck. There's also natural catastrophes. There are all these different pressures that come to bear, and somehow nature muddles along. It changes, or it tends to change and improve, or maybe not always improve. And I just think that the lack of deliberateness of Chroma maybe its greatest strength. I mean, I don't really know how cooperatives work, but I suspect that there are autocrats and dictators in cooperatives too. People in charge that tell everybody else what to do.
I guess it depends on the cooperative. I'll give you two examples: the Burley Design Cooperative. It was kind of the way Chroma started, where you had a group of people that were all very interested in doing one thing. They wanted this alternative format. So when they put it together as a cooperative, they all had one share, one vote. They all, you know, kind of rotated and did all the work. But as they grew, they were meeting kind of the same scaling pressures. But they had hired in a corporate manager to restructure it, went downhill from there. Because they wanted to keep it more democratic, more fair in the voting decision-making processes, but as they hired more people because of seasonal work and increases, it diluted that culture. Mm. But on the other hand, you have a industrial giant like Mondragon in Spain, and I can't speak to whether or not they have autocrats and dictators, but the technical level that they took to developing their culture and their management systems was at the forefront of, you know, really researching and looking with academics and you know, people who are actively doing it. And I think one of the major parts that their internal bank spent a lot of money on was that research alone.
Yeah.
Because I think by maybe the early 90s, maybe even before then, they had upward of about 100 different industrial manufacturers, and actually in a whole range of different, I guess, industries. But
yeah,
there's different relationships there. So going back to Chroma, I think what you're talking about, there's, you know, to pull a word from something from a previous conversation we had, there's this element of magic that you can't quite pin down on what has pushed Chroma along for 25 right. years now.
Yeah, I there is that element of magic, but also I think people confuse employee ownership with employee governance. And
they're not all, I mean, they're not mutually exclusive, but they're not always together in the same boat. Right.
And so often when people would say to me, I did this and I got shouted at or whatever by whoever, I would say, well, look, you know, just because you get the same, just because we all get paid the same and we get great benefits doesn't mean you know as much as somebody else. So I wouldn't try and do things that you're not competent to do. If Paul knows best in the sales department, let him do it. You're not being asked to take an active. You're not necessarily being asked to take an active part in the way the company is run. You're being asked to do what you know how to do and do it well and get well compensated for doing it. And I'm not even sure if this idea of everybody in a room together voting on whether we hire this guy or that guy is really necessary. I mean, I'm not even sure if democracy is the best in the workplace is the best approach, really.
What's the immediate alternative? An autocratic hierarchy?
Well, a benign dictatorship is not an unreasonable thing. I'm not sure that I know. I mean, if people in a department will say we need better ventilation, we need this equipment. I've thought of a new way of doing this. Can we do that? They say sure, that's great, go for it. Order what you need. But 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 that doesn't mean you're empowered automatically to you know, call the contractors in and build an addition. You know, let somebody else worry about that. So there's got to be a balance between democracy on one level and benign authority on another. Not malign authority, where people are raking all the money off the workers' backs and salting it away. But a benign small group running a company, I don't have a problem with that. I didn't even want to be one of those benign authoritative figures. I let the people that know how to do it best do it. I didn't even want to be on the board half the time. It bored me.
I think what you're kind of describing as benign authority is kind of consistent with the way I'm seeing the management structure develop at Chroma. In fact, that so what they've recently created is five chief positions. See if I can remember all of them: operations, technical, customer, executive, and finance. Currently held by three people, but you know that is board, C-suite. Then you have, I guess, a set of managers that they're putting together. They're not necessarily the same people that would have been on the steering committee, where they're the head of this group or the leader, etc. But hired in, or hired from the actual company itself internally into these positions to do all that coordination and making sure that there's planning going on. They're not ordering people what to do, but they're maintaining that autonomy within the individual worker and the work groups, but kind of pulling all that together. So there you have the work, individual worker, the work groups, that management team, while I don't think it's officially called that, the C-suite and the board. And I think for the most part they are kind of hitting now what you're talking about is this benign it's very interesting to see how it's being pulled together, because all their doors are always open. They talked in a company meeting yesterday that you can, if you don't know who to talk to, you can literally just go to the chief of X position and have the conversation.
Yeah.
So I think it's very interesting. Yeah.
And I, in a way, I would have said, well, it's probably always been that way on some level. If I think about any work group, I was able to recognize who would be the natural leader of that. I mean, it's just something that evolves. If it was configuring, I believe that's what it used to be called, handling the glass, cutting it, drilling it, shaping it, and all the rest of it, inventing machines to do that. There was always somebody that was obviously the natural leader of that group, and that was the person you would talk to if you had a problem. I guess in my view of the company culture, there was never a problem with going to somebody and saying, hey, we got to do this, we got to do that. But it is true that in the later years, I would see a lot of people who didn't feel empowered enough to even go and find out or know how to recognize the natural leader of a group and say, we have a problem to address. They would sort of, I don't know. I mean, not everybody is intuitive about who's got the right answers and who doesn't, or who's going to be the best resource. But
I would say that maybe one of the downfalls of the expansion of the company now, grossing 110, is that sometimes because of the way the building and, I guess, different parts of the production, the facility, and I guess the company, one person is always in this room over here and never ends up going to the other room on the other side of the building, so may not ever...
Yeah, well, see, that's their own fault. I mean, I made it a point always to wander around during the day, just see how people, things, what's going on. Oh, that's new. Where'd you get that? Oh, Dan made that. I like to know what's going on, and I would wander around and say hi to people, and people would know who I was, who I am. If people don't want to leave their department and go to other departments and say, that looks interesting, what are you doing? Tell me, who are you? What are you doing? How's that work? Well, then they should. That's part of what you expect employee owners to be doing. Is I'm not trying to steal your job, but I don't expect you to have secrets from me either. I want to know what's going on. Good. It should be an open book. The whole place should be an open book.
All right, Frank, so I'm here at, or I guess we're here at 55 minutes or so. Same length as most of the interviews, but, in closing out the interview, are there any final comments you want to make about the company? Any specific things in the history or the culture that you want to remark on that we haven't so far?
having left, having left the company, I don't really think about. I don't really worry about it. I presume it's going to go on, because it seems to have a life of its own. Though it, and I presume, but from what some people say, including yourself, one wonders if it really does have a life of its own, or if it's still almost entirely dependent on founder influence and culture. I mean, that would be the big question for me is if all of the founders vanished overnight, for whatever reason. I mean, if Paul and Jay killed each other in a duel with pistols, and Dick fell out of a window and Vim's head exploded from too much coding. If all the founders vanished, would the company keep going? Or is there, in some mysterious way, is everybody there highly dependent on the founders that are still there? And if they left, could it... I don't know what... In other words, I don't know if the model that is Chroma is sustainable.
And I, honestly, from my observation, it seemed like that is a constant question, a constant constant concern, and it's constantly being worked on. To what degree and how much time is a question of what is really important at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So the big question is if you can define, if anyone can define what Chroma is in terms of its structure and governance, is that something that's sustainable or without the force of certain personalities.
Well, thank you very much, Frank.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope. Thank you.